Without a context, the Bible can be made to say anything. I knew of this one preacher that preached against women wearing top knots on their head. And he got it out of the place where it says, if you're on the housetop, not come down. If a lady's on the housetop, not come down. He took the phrase, top knot, come down, and he was preaching against the mountain gals that put their hair up all the time and all thinking they're righteous and everything, and they aren't. He said, bring it top knot down. You know, completely, completely out of context. Okay? Listen to this. I sat in a service one time and heard a preacher preaching about doting about to change thy ways. And he called it dotting about to change thy ways. Have you ever heard the phrase doting about to change their ways? You ever heard that phrase? It's in the Old Testament. And he thought that meant dotting. He said, well, would you, a sentence, write a sentence and you don't want to finish the sentence and you go dot, 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 dot. He said, people just don't want to finish anything. That was his whole sermon. People dotting about. And they never finish anything. They're always wanting to change stuff. Completely out of context. Let me give you an illustration of a word in context. Somebody, I'm going to give you a word, and I want you to tell me the first definition that comes to mind. Okay? So fast as we can do this, all right? The word is fast. Quick. Anything else? What? A rabbit? Speedy? What? Don't eat? The flash? Okay, so let me give you a sentence. Okay? Here's the sentence. Now you said don't eat. Somebody said quick. Okay, so I'm gonna say the girl is fast. What did that just say? Yeah, but what does that mean? What are you picturing? You think she's quick? She runs fast? Well, now you've added a word to what I just said. The girl's fast. How about if she's loose morals? How about if she's stuck to the bench? The bench was painted in its wet paint, and she is fast to the bench. You see what I'm saying? You can say the girl is fast, and you're going to interpret what you heard based on what you understand of what's being said. And when I say the girl is fast, I'm thinking she sat in wet paint and she stuck to the bench. You're thinking she's a fast runner because that's based on what you're thinking, your perspective. That's how we get so many different interpretations of the Bible. We get a lot of interpretations because people will take a verse and they'll read it and they'll interpret it based upon their upbringing or their lenses. Okay? A guy told me one time that God was a Baptist. I said, how do you, he was serious as a heart attack. And I started to say something really bad. It wasn't good. He was serious. And I said, how do you say God's a Baptist? He said, well, if you're a Presbyterian, will you send out Presbyterian missionaries? I said, well, probably. He said, if you're a Methodist, will you send out Methodist missionaries? I said, probably. He said, well, read John. There was a man sent from God, his name was John. So God sent out John the Baptist, so God is a Baptist. Okay, then. That's what he thought. I don't think God's a Baptist, frankly. It's not whether he's on our side, it's whether we're on his, Abe Lincoln's side. See what I'm saying? We don't set the rules for him, right? So his denomination is probably completely obscure from what we think it is. He says, you thought I was such an one as yourself, right? So this guy, he was seeing everything through a Baptist lens. And so he said, I'm a Baptist, God's a Baptist, everybody's a Baptist, and you've got to be a Baptist to be a part of the Bride of Christ. And everything he interpreted through the Bible, everything he read in the Bible, was based on that theory. Now, you can make the Bible say just about anything you want it to say. The Mormons, for example, teach that Jesus and the devil are brothers. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of things that are taught. I have heard, and I'm not going to get too far into this, so please forgive me, I'm going to mention it, drop it, and walk away. But I've heard that it's sin for a man to wear a tie. You like that, don't you? The reasons are messed up. I'm going to tell you, it's a messed up reason. But a guy's written books on it. I've heard all kinds of things. I've heard that women should never cut their hair. I've heard never trim it, never anything, never trim their hair, never should never wear jewelry, should never wear makeup. I've heard all kinds of things. You can take anything you want and you can preach it in here. I've heard a whole group of churches, I heard about this one this weekend. A whole bunch of guys down in another state, a long ways from here, that are teaching that men should discipline their wives. Anywhere in that book. And I'm just going to tell you guys, don't try it. It isn't a good idea. Because you won't have one anymore. That's not right. A wife is a gift. And if you guys are single, you appreciate the fact that it's a miracle for you to get married. And if you're married, it's a miracle you're still married. A wife is a gift from God. And it's miraculous, okay? You should never treat a lady ever like that. But they're getting that stuff from the Bible. You could teach any nonsense you want to teach from the Bible, okay? So it's very, very important that you read everything in its context. Context principle is crucial. There are different kinds of context. We're going to talk about these. There's a near context. Now, we're going to use the board here. I'm just going to write it up here, okay? Just so you can picture it in your head. There's the near context. There's the remote context. There's the historical context. I don't think I wrote these in order. What's the other one? The complete context. Okay. These are the four different kinds of contexts that I've discovered, okay, that I've heard and read about, and the ones that I believe are true. Near context, what do you think that means? Tell me what that means. Verses, what do you think? Directly around the verse. Verses directly around the verse, right? Everything, you know, when I say the girl is fast, you also want to know whether we're talking about a race, a painted thing, or loose morals, or, you know, you're wanting to know what we're talking about. Heard of this guy this morning. He was talking about a friend of his showed him how important a stationary bike was, and he was talking about how, you know, you can sit in these machines and you can move them, and you know, and you don't have to go anywhere, and it really builds the right muscle groups and everything. And so he said he went home and he realized the value of it, and he promptly nailed his running shoes to the floor. Good. In 20 minutes, he goes and stands in them, works out, nailed to the floor, because he found out that stationary exercise is very good for you. Anyway, back to context. Near context is every verse around. What's remote context? What do you think that would be? Remote, think about it.
The book?
Yeah, it would be everything on that topic, okay? And that topic could be, I mean, it could be... I did a study on angels. Now, here's the interesting thing. There are over 800 verses in the Bible that directly reference angels. Now, don't look up angels and count those verses. What do you think you'd have to look up to find that? Give me some names if we're going to talk about angels.
Gabriel,
Michael, Lucifer, anything else? Messenger,
Archangel,
Fallen Angel, Angel of the Lord,
Angel of Death,
Seraphim, Cherubim, right? And the list goes on. Lucifer, right? So, when we're talking remote context, we're talking about every topic that would dovetail with that. The angel said, the angel of the Lord said, the angel of death, you know, God sent a messenger. You know, there's a messenger of Satan, right? Messenger of Satan to buffet me. What is that? Ooh. Everybody says the messenger of Satan was Paul had a problem with his eyes. And wait a second. God sent a thorn of the flesh, a messenger of Satan. Interesting, you said messenger. It's remotely connected. The messenger of Satan, Paul's thorn in the flesh, is remotely connected to angels because it's a messenger. Right? So anytime you find the word messenger, remotely connected. So you see what I'm saying? That's context. Context is pretty big. Anything you can think about. Historical context. This is what we talked about, manners and customs. Manners and customs of Bible lands. Finding out, for example, dipping the sop. Can you tell me what dipping the sop means? Jesus said, the one that's going to dip the sop with me is Judas. Well, there's a big bowl in the center. They had these little falafels or things like little tacos or those kind of things, and they would dip them in the dish. And if two guys dipped in at the same time, you know, we like to go to Don Sol's Mexican restaurant, and they bring out these bowls of chips and these bowls of salsa, and you take those chips. That's an old custom. That's what it meant to dip the sop. Take your thing and dip it in there, and that's what you would eat. So those historical contexts, when Jesus says, if someone asks you to go with him a mile, go with him twain. Like, are we talking Uber? Lyft? Subway? Train? Walk? Talking about somebody wants you to go exercise with them? What are we talking about? You see, somebody that has no idea the context needs to understand a historical background. Does anybody know what the historical background is for that phrase? It's a Roman. Okay, so what happened was, in Roman times, there was a law that if you were, if a Jew, a Roman soldier, was walking down the road, a Jew was walking on the sidewalk. If a Roman soldier was walking down the sidewalk, a Jew had to step off so he would not be higher than the Roman soldier. If the Roman soldier looked at you and said, I need you to carry my armor for a mile, there was a law on the Roman books that if a Roman soldier conscripted you and said, you have to carry my armor for a mile, that you had to do it. Now, at the end of a mile, you didn't have to carry it anymore. You could put it down at the end of the mile and walk away. But by law, you had to carry it for a mile. So you go to the store to buy Dorito chips, and you're headed back home, and your wife's looking for her cell phone, and she doesn't have it. Oh, it wasn't invented yet. What do I do? Where is he? What's he doing? Well, he's out carrying the Roman soldier's armor for a mile. It's going to take him a while to get home. And no cell phone to contact you, but that was the Roman law. So Jesus said, if he makes you carry it 1 mile, say, here, I'll carry another mile. This one's on me. Go to him. See, that's a historical context. Make sense? Okay. Complete context. This one is fascinating to me in that when I think about the Bible being an entire unit, you'll find out that some things you need to interpret within the context of the whole book itself. Remember, we're talking about gray areas, the direction they're headed? This is talking about the direction of the book. Okay? What is the direction of the book? Jesus said, I came for what purpose? Yeah, seek and save that which is lost. He said, I'm not here to condemn you, I'm here to save you. The Bible is not about judgment. The Bible talks about judgment. It warns us about judgment. But the message is not judgment, is it? What's the message of the Bible? Redemption. Salvation. That's the whole message. So the complete context, you know, it's always pointing that direction. I've heard people say to me, well, we don't have any of these old-fashioned preachers preaching hellfire and brimstone. Let me tell you something. You should be afraid of hellfire, and you should preach about hellfire when you become a preacher. You ladies, you should teach about it. But the truth is that the Bible is not about hellfire. One of the first things that someone directed my attention when I was studying Revelation, when it started opening up the book of Revelation to me, is I realized that the book of Revelation is not about the Antichrist. Everyone goes to the book of Revelation and looking for the Antichrist. Ah, the microchip. Ah, that's the 666 because we're putting our identity in the right hand and the forehead. And wow, black helicopters, FEMA, wow. You know, Revelation is not about any of that. Revelation is about Jesus Christ. When you understand that, that's the direction of the book. That's the complete context of the book. It unlocks some of the mysteries of the book. Make sense? So context is very, very, very important. We have some examples of that. You can look at them. Near context, Hebrews 11:6. Let's take the verse, by faith Enoch was translated. He should not see death, was not found because God had translated him. Before his translation, he had this testimony. He pleased God, okay? So the near context, Hebrews 11:6 says, without faith it's impossible to please him. He that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that is reward of them that diligently seek him. Verse 5 is part of an entire topic. You look at the near context, surrounding it. Remote context, go to the original story, Genesis 5. Jude tells us more about Enoch. 1 Thessalonians 4, 13-18 talks about more on the translation subject. These are remote contexts and things about being raptured and what that all means. The complete context, Hebrews 11:5, God with us. That's the point. God wants us to be with him. Matthew 24 says about the historical context of Hebrews 11:5. As in the days of Noah, that's the time Enoch lived in, as in the days of Noah. And I don't know if we'll get into this, but briefly, Enoch, the time Enoch lived in, the days of Noah that he lived in, people try to tell you there was demons came and cohabited with humans and produced some kind of off-brand, offshoot. I'm going to tell you something that does not match the complete context of the Bible. Have you guys heard this? Have you heard about the half-man, half-demon? Have you heard about that stuff? Okay, so I'm gonna take a second here. Did I throw my eraser on the floor? I've got to show you this. If we run into tomorrow, we will. These first few are really take a little more time to build, and then the rest of the book goes faster. But as in the days of Noah, so shall the days of the coming of the Son of Man be. Genesis chapter 6. Somebody read Genesis 6. What is it? What verse is it? It says, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men. Read that verse for me. Does anybody have with them a phone concordance? You got the verse? Hold on, hold that verse. Hold on a sec. Anybody got a phone concordance that they're using and they have with them? Anybody got one? You got a Bible app, or anybody got a Bible app on their phone? You have one? Okay, I want you to type in the phrase, sons of God. Okay, you do that for me? Okay, you read that verse.
Verse 4, there were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that when the sons of God came unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, the same became mighty men, which were men which were of old, men of renown.
What's this verse? Giants? In those days, and then what's it say? What's it say next?
Also after that.
Also after that. In other words, not connected to this thought necessarily. Not a reaction from this. Just there were giants in land in those days. Also after that, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men. That it says, those men became men of renown. Basic fact, my friends, is in Genesis chapter 6, people were living to be 900 years old. Okay? Some of them were big. Some of them continued to grow. DNA was a lot purer in its form. It was not broke down as far as it is right now. DNA has broken down and broken down and broken down and split and split and split and split and split so many times. It was not that weak. It was all still pretty close to creation. There were a lot of giants. People make a big deal about the word Nephilim. And when they start talking to you about the Nephilim, sounds like they know their Hebrew. And they really don't. They know their Book of Enoch. The Book of Enoch is the thing that talks. The Book of Enoch is where everybody gets the idea that demons came and cohabited with men and produced giants. In fact, there's this big thing out there right now. It's not called the Anakim. It's called the Anaki. Has anybody heard of the Anaki? It's all over the internet. You can look it up if you want. It's stupid. But they claim that there's these people from another planet called the Anaki that came down and caused us to be a superhuman race. And the Anaki is where some of these people will tell you that's where the Anakim come from. And the Anakim are sons of Cain. Anakim means sons of Cain. And the truth is, the Anakim came after the flood, not before the flood. And does anybody remember what happened to the sons of Cain? They all died in the flood. There was no sons of Cain after the flood. So the Anakim and the Anaki, whatever you want to call them, the Nephilim, you just want to mess around with names and words, whatever you want to do. But let's go to the English and see if we can define what sons of God are. So do you have a list of verses? Read me a list of verses. The first one you find probably is in the book of Job. Is that right? Is that right? Job 1?
Well, the way it looks it up, it looks for each word individually.
Oh, you want a phrase, and we don't want to do that. Because there's like six or seven. Oh, let me tell you where if somebody's got it, go find the list. But Job 1, it says, the sons of God came in to present themselves before the Lord. And Satan also came among them. It doesn't say Satan was a son of God. It says Satan came amongst them. That's significant. Find this phrase in the New Testament. You got a verse? John 1:12. What's it say? Them that received him, he gave power to become the sons of God. Let me ask you something. Does that mean he calls them to become angels? Now, in Job 1, is it talking about angels? Yes. Satan came amongst those angels. They called him the sons of God. John 1:12 says, but as many as received him, to them gave he power to become the sons of God. Okay? Does that mean he's going to make them angels? Can you find another phrase in the New Testament say sons of God? What's it say?
For as many as are led by the Spirit of God, they are the sons of God.
Oh, I love that verse. Romans 8:14. Romans 8:14. John 1:12. So what do we learn about the sons of God in Romans 8:14? As many as are led by the Spirit of God, they are the sons of God. Would that include angels? Could. If they're led by the Spirit of God, would it include fallen angels? No. Why not? They chose to walk away from God. They weren't being led by God, are they? They're going against God, not with God, right? So fallen angels, it couldn't be the sons of God. And that's who people say in Genesis 6. They say it's fallen angels cohabited with humans. Not possible. Because 1 John's another one. 1 John 3, I think it is. You got it? You got it? What does it say? Beloved, now are we the
sons of God.
Why, are we angels right now? Closer to fallen angels than anything, right? Now, Why are we the sons of God now? Because we are believers and followers of God, and we are following the Spirit of God. Those who follow the Spirit of God are the sons of God, right? Those verses right there completely eliminate the possibility of this being fallen angels. Can't be. Not possible. Okay? So right now we know by using context, the complete context of the story, we can find out that in remote context, we can find out that that is not talking. And here's the thing. If you say Genesis 6 is talking about fallen angels, then what you've just done is you've taken Genesis 6 and taken it completely out of the redemption story. And it has really nothing to do with us. Now, the book of Enoch claims that Enoch himself went and testified to God and prayed to God not to kill the angels. Look, the Bible is not about angels, even though there's over 800 verses that have to do with angels. What is the Bible about? Redemption and Jesus Christ and his followers. That's what it's about. That's the complete context. So here's the story. Genesis 6, and we'll talk about this when we talk about Revelation, which is one of the appendixes. Genesis 6 is part of the story of man losing his way. Man got judged in Genesis 6, not the angels. Okay? Now there's a mention in 1 Peter of the angels that left their first estate are kept in chains. And here's what's interesting. The people that believe that this is about fallen angels, they say that those are the angels that fell, left their first estate, and tried to become human. And then they tell you that after the flood, these fallen angels were still running around the earth and so on, and that's what demons are. And I'm going to tell you something, that's not true. There are references in the Bible that talk about fallen angels. How many of you know what's the name of the king of the bottomless pit? The king of the bottomless pit, what's his name? No. Beelzebub means prince of flies, by the way. No. His name, it starts with A. Hath the Greek name, Apollyon. It's also called Abaddon. He's Abaddon. Well, anyway, So Abaddon and Apollyon is his name. Now, some of the fanciful writers, have tried to make Apollyon and Abaddon the same as Lucifer. Lucifer is a different guy. Apollyon is the king of the bottomless pit. He's in charge of it. Lucifer's never been in charge of the bottomless pit. He's not in charge of hell. Satan's not in charge of hell. Satan's going to be thrown in the lake of fire. He's going to be tormented. When Satan is put in the bottomless pit, get this, Revelation 20, he's going to be thrown in the bottomless pit and he's going to be chained up for 1,000 years. Who's in charge of him? Who's watching him? Apollyon's watching him. Apollyon's one of the good guys. Read your Bible, see? That's what's in the Bible. But if you read extra-biblical sources, they'll tell you Apollyon is Lucifer, or he's a bad guy, he's got, you know, horns and a forked stick and all this kind of stuff. He's actually on God's side. He's one of the ones that's the king over the bottomless pit. He's the one in charge. He's the one in charge of keeping Lucifer bound up. That's the way I can read it. That's the way I read it. That's what I understand. Okay? You might be able to take it a different way, but that's the way I take it. It's interesting. So, context principle, it's going to page 34. Context principle is going to answer difficult questions. It's going to show you, let me give you this real quick. It's going to show you difficult questions. It's going to, page 40, it's going to shed light on a particular story. Page 41, the context principle will protect the truth. And we talk about eternal security there. Context will teach you eternal security. And page 46, context principle will define a word. We don't have time to get into all the detail there, But one of my favorite context principle studies is the book of Job. I used to wonder, okay, when was the book of Job written? So here's what we did. Using the context principle, do some sleuthing. Open your Bible to the book of Job. How many of you have heard that Job is the oldest book in the Bible? You heard that? Okay. Have you heard that nobody knows when Job was written? How many of you have heard that? Okay. So when I was about your age, I got frustrated with that. And I said, let's see if we can figure this out. And I sat down and I started sleuthing through the book of Job. Let's see what Job says about itself using the context. So tell me the very first thing you find out about Job. Tell me what it is. Okay, wait, stop, sorry. What's the first thing you find out? There was a man. So Job equals a man. Okay, that's how detailed we want to get. Look at every little detail. What's the next thing we find? Lived in the land of Uz. What else do we find out? His name was Job. What else do we find out? He was perfect and upright, so he was upright and perfect, okay? So he wasn't a monkey, he was upright. No, that's right. Okay, perfect and upright. What else? He feared God, okay? So we're finding out these are things about his character, right? Those are important things. What else do we find out? He hated evil. He hated evil. Feared God, hated evil. Had a bunch of kids. Seven sons, three daughters. He was wealthy. Wealthy, so wealthy that Satan said, and Satan said, you have put a what around him? A hedge. Now, what happened when the hedge was lifted? Yes, what happened? Give them to me in the order. There are four things that happened. What happened? First thing happened. What happened? First thing was his cattle. What happened that he lost his cattle? What's it say? The Sabians, what did they do? And stole his cattle. So Sabians stole his cattle. Okay? Second thing that happened. Was that the second thing? Okay, and the servants, so they stole the oxen and the servants, all right? Well, I'm not going to write all that down, but those are all important. I did when I was studying this. Chaldeans, is that number two? Or number three? So number two is, what did you say was the fire of God? Okay, so what was number three? Chaldeans? What did the Chaldeans do? He took his camels. Okay, and killed the servants. What? Number four, what happened? The fourth thing happened. This is when his children died. A wind from the wilderness. Wind from wilderness. Now, here's what I want you to see about this. These four things happened when this was lifted. What does that tell you? If you have a wall that's protecting you from something, what's going on outside of that wall? All this stuff. When the wall hits or is lifted, then all this stuff happens to you, right? When the wall's down, you're protected from it. Does that make sense? Okay, so that's the hedge. The hedge was lifted. Now, here's what we do. We go back and we find out something interesting. There was only one book of the Bible that maybe two, that mentioned the Sabians. I'm not going to go into Uz and all of that because I have that in the book. If you want to look it up, you can read some more of the stuff, where Uz was and where it came from and who the descendants, and I studied all that. But let's look at verse 30, or page 37. The Sabians attacked. No, it's three. Three other times in the Bible. Isaiah, Ezekiel, and Joel. Isaiah, Ezekiel, and Joel. Now, tell me, are those pre-exilic, post-exilic, or exilic prophets? Except for this one. That's exilic, right? And these are pre-exilic. Why is that important? Okay. Why is this important? It gives you the time frame. Okay, so let's go back to 1362. And let's read some writings by this one guy. And he mentions President George Washington of the United States of America. Is it possible? Why? 1362. Remember American history? Remember 1776? Remember that? Huh? So 1362 is years before it ever happened. If you go back to 1300, you're not going to find anything about the Americas. Nothing about it. Right? Because of the time frame. Interesting to find out Sabians are mentioned during the exile and just before the exile, and they're mentioned as judgment from God. You guys, can you say the same thing about the Chaldeans? What was the exile? Who took them into exile? The Chaldeans. Nebuchadnezzar. Right? You're going to find the Chaldeans mentioned. Where is it? Only five books were written during the time frame of the Sabians. Isaiah, Habakkuk, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel. Chaldeans. Where is that? I wrote that in here somewhere. I'm not following it very good, but is that right? Bottom of 38? Yeah, that's it. Same time frame as the Sabians is actually Chaldeans. Okay, so number three. Okay, I'm misreading here. Third thing that happened, it was the Chaldeans attack. Only five books of the Bible mention this group of people. Those five books were written during the same time frame as the Sabians. Isaiah was pre-exilic, Habakkuk pre-exilic, Jeremiah both pre-exilic and exilic during the Babylonian, and Daniel during the Babylonian exile. So you've got Isaiah, Habakkuk, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel are the ones that talk about the Chaldeans. The only five books in the Bible that mention the Chaldeans. So what is that? Just those two things start giving you the idea that the book of Job might have happened in the same time frame as Isaiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, etc., right? You see what I'm saying? Gives you that idea. Well, then you look at these two judgments. And do you know these two judgments? You can read it in the book. These fire of God and wind from the wilderness were both predicted to come on Israel for judgment from God. And the pre-exilic prophets prophesied God's going to send a fire, and he's going to be a destroying fire, and several times in the book of Jeremiah. And the wind from the wilderness, he's going to come send the wind from the wilderness, basically was going to destroy the crops. Interesting, those things all happened, this all happened to Israel during the exile. But Job was perfect and hated evil and served God, and there was a hedge around him. And God said, you looking at Job? Satan says, yeah, you got a hedge around him. Take the hedge off and let me at him. God lift the hedge, and everything that happened to Israel during this time period happened to Job. What does that tell you? Historical context tells you something, doesn't it? Tells you that Job was written during the exile. Fascinating. It's also going to teach you a lot of stuff, interesting stuff. If you serve God and love God in the middle of a culture burning down, God will protect you. And if he takes the hedge up, him and the devil are having a conversation, and you'll be okay. That's a pretty neat story, isn't it? Huh? That comes from this one principle, context principle. See how important the context principle is? You got it? All right, guys, gals, you've been a good class. You can look at the other stuff. There's interesting things about, I want to tell you this. I won't probably get it tomorrow. Context principle will define a word. You'll find in the King James Bible, oftentimes a complex word will be defined in its context. For example, Genesis 49:17 uses the word adder. Some people say adder is an archaic word. It says an adder, a serpent by the way. A serpent by the way is an adder. The context itself defines it. I asked somebody the other day, they were asking me about a word. It was a brand new Christian. She just got saved a month ago. And she says, this phrase, particular phrase, what does that mean? And I said, what do you think it means? And she says, well, I think it means this. I said, that's exactly what it means. I said, how did I know that? Because you read it in the Bible, and the Bible itself defined it. The context itself defined it. Oftentimes, people will tell you the King James Bible is too hard to understand. The King James Bible is built on cognitive scaffolding, which is small phrases and small concepts built one upon another. And if you read the context, you'll be able to figure out exactly what it's saying. All right? Thank you. That's it for now. God bless you.